Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Fall is here, so get cozy and take a cruise around iTunes for lots of other NPR podcasts, including How to Do Everything, Thoughts on Regrettable Television, What Happens When Your Brilliant Plan Falls Apart, and What Your Homeowner's Insurance Policy Really Says. Browse them all on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll be diving, without spoilers, into the new, fascinating David Fincher film, Gone Girl, based on a novel that we have spoken about before. After that, we will talk a little bit about some of the things that we have learned from pop culture. And we'll close the show, as always, with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And actually, our guest this week is not in Studio 44. She is out in California. Everyone knows her, and we love her very much. Our friend Barry Hardiman. Barry,
thanks.
What do you do at NPR?
I am an editor at Weekend Edition.
Well, you know, some of you may remember that one of the first times we talked about Gone Girl on this show was when Barry, and I think our friend Pyrrhul Segal at that time, talked about this book and how much they loved it. And so we thought it was only right to bring back Barry for this conversation. Now, we are going to try to have this conversation as unspoiled as possible. Later, we'll be putting out a little short, small batch, if you've been listening to those, where Barry and I will delve into some of these spoiled points of the movie and book. But we're going to do our best. At the same time, it is really hard to talk about this movie and preserve every surprise.
Now, just to help, I have done my part and not actually seen the movie.
That is not true. He is lying. But it is almost impossible to preserve absolutely everything. So just be cognizant of the fact that if you need everything to be in a sealed container, you can always come back and listen to this segment later. So that's the intro that I wanted to give. So I know Barry has seen the movie and read the book. And I know that, Glenn, you had read the book prior to seeing the movie, correct?
I certainly had, yeah.
And Stephen, you have not read the book, but you have seen the movie.
Correct.
So I'm going to start actually with Thompson.
Because as the least qualified.
No, not at all. Because
I think it's actually great.
Because your perspective is unique, because you hadn't read the book. So you are the only one of us who went into this movie cold.
Your ignorance is an asset.
Well, yeah. And I do try as much as possible to go into movies, whatever we're going to be talking about on this show. I try never to read reviews, I try to remain blissfully ignorant.
This is my point.
So that I can go in as fresh as possible. And actually, while watching Gone Girl, about a third of the way into the movie, I remember sitting there, and this is an enviable position to be in. I sat and I thought, I think there's a twist coming up. I remember something about, like, halfway through the book, there was some twist. And so that was the extent to which I had been spoiled. And so I really managed to sit along and just ride the waves of this movie exactly as I was intended to ride them. I mean, I'm sure I could have stopped and maybe thought more, in terms of what might be getting telegraphed. Every once in a while, I would see something and think, I think that cat is foreshadowing, but I don't know for what.
That cat represents something.
That cat
that's
represents,
a symbolic cat.
Maybe it's ennui. But it was a really nice way to see that movie because I wound up completely properly manipulated by it. And at the end of the movie, and I'm not giving away anything at all, but it was a fascinating experience. I went on a Monday night. The theater was probably a quarter full, as it often is on Monday night. And at the end of the movie, the last shot, and then the credits roll, and there was just this slow, stunned inhalation in the theater. It sounded a little something like,
it was just you. Yeah. I think what we can say, and this is kind of what I have determined, I think it is fair to say, is that, and I think we've said some of this on the show before, that this story is really divided into a part that is a mystery and then a part that is more a suspense thriller.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Because what happens in this movie and book is that they resolve the mystery of the missing wife, because the setup is Ben Affleck's character, whose name is Nick, comes home and finds that his wife, whose name is Amy, is missing. very often in a mystery, what you would get is it goes on all the way until the end of the movie, and then there's some climactic fight or something where you learn what has happened, and it kind of comes all at once, and then it deflates, and you find out, and then it was over. This movie puts that discovery sort of in the middle. You learn what happened, and then this back half of the movie is dealing with that revelation and confronting whatever it is that has happened. Mm-hmm. And so I think you can say that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We've been suitably vague.
Yeah.
Now that I've already said it.
I am blessed and cursed with the fact that I don't remember books that I read. Like,
yeah.
They just vanish. Mm-hmm. I remembered what you call the revelation. Everything else was gone. So it was almost as if I was coming at this for the first time. I just don't remember plot. I remember language. I remember turns of phrase. I remember moments. But I don't read for plot. I don't care about plot. This is related to why my fiction is not, was once called a lacking in moment and inert workshop. Love it. Anyway,
workshop.
I don't remember from the book this tone that Fincher puts on the film, which is very oppressive and tense, claustrophobic. Fincher is often called a very cold, clinical director. Not here. The presentation is very flat and affectless, I guess, but you feel this incredible...
Affectless.
Affectless, yes, good. And the other thing I got a little bit more clearly from the movie than the book were some of the motivations, because in the book, the characters are speaking in first person, and I have an instinctive distrust of first person. People who's telling you a story in first person is shaping the story, and it's kind of interesting how this film uses first person because it comes in and out.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that the music, this incredible score, comes in and out, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that the flashbacks that are happening throughout the course of the film, at least they start accompanied by music. And the other parts of the film have no music. And then gradually, right about that revelation, is when the music starts to bleed into everything.
Yeah.
In a way that pulls you further into the story in a big way. So I liked it. It was a different experience for me than the book was, but I liked it a lot.
Yeah. Barry, when you, I wanted to ask you what you think, in unspoiled terms, what you think of some of the performances in the movie. For the purposes of talking about the performances, I think it's safe to say that both Nick and his wife have kind of dark edges to their characters. That's sort of how they maintain in the early going this tension, is you increasingly learn that neither one of these people, as you kind of unravel this marriage. How did you like the performances, Barry?
I did think that Rosamund Pike was absolutely fabulous. Mm-hmm. I found her hard to take my eyes off of. I loved listening to her. I loved looking at her. I thought she was very, very well cast. She had, and there is, you know, the movie is a lot more Hitchcockian than the book is. And so to see this real Hitchcock heroine, I mean, she, especially toward the later half of the movie, she is a dead ringer for Rear Window, which I just loved. I thought she was just fabulous. I really liked Ben Affleck. I wanted to see his flaws a little more clearly.
Yeah.
There is more first person from him in the book. And so those things feel... they feel closer to the surface.
Yeah.
But so for me, that was, she really took the cake. I thought she was just, I just loved watching her. But I will also say, I think I maybe didn't like the movie as much as everyone else did. And by everyone else, it seems like it's gotten rave reviews across the board. For maybe exactly the reason that Glenn was talking about in terms of what stuck. What stuck for me, all of the sort of the elements that you're talking about of, you know, the darkness and the sort of the claustrophobia, which I did actually find in the book a little bit, although it's more that kind of, she's describing an economic claustrophobia, I think, very well. Mm-hmm. I have found, you know, a couple days later that the movie is absolutely gone from me. Gone
Interesting.
Girl. And that does not usually happen for me with a movie that I really, really like. This one was had a meringue quality, like wasn't that fun.
Well,
and then I went home and I promptly fell asleep and forgot everything except for her outfit in the last scene.
The American Hustle syndrome.
It's very, for me, the reason that may have happened is that I think the movie is very true to the book. And I think both are very plot driven.
Yeah.
And so if you do know the story, what you get is a really good performance of the plot in the book.
Yeah.
And I think there is some bringing to life of the plot in the book. But I think if you already know this tremendous story, this really, in, like, sort of not just intelligent as in like intelligent and thoughtful, but just like it's well done.
It's
the
smart.
Story.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you've already had that story unspool once and then you see it unspool again, you can appreciate the aesthetics of it. I can appreciate certain things about Fincher's directing and certainly the performances. And that's why I come back to these things. But I do think it's hard for the movie to land as much and when you have already seen that story.
Well, and the two of you are essentially, in a sense, like rewatching this story. And
right. So it's like, a little bit like watching a cover band.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
Right. It is. Even if a really good cover band.
It's like expecting the second watch of something you really love to land as hard as the first. You know the beats a little bit more.
Right. But you're putting your finger on something that I was thinking about. I also thought this about the book. This book, this movie, I think movie maybe more than a book, has launched a thousand think pieces about feminism, misogyny, women, men, marriage, gender. And I want to stipulate that any piece of art, any piece of entertainment can generate such conversations. Now, I'm not saying this isn't worthy of doing that. My reaction whenever I read any of these things, these very long pieces, is like, really this? Because this film...
I feel the same way.
This film especially feels... Contrived is the wrong word. It's in and about itself.
It's specific. It's specific to these people.
It's not overwrought, but it is very, very wrought. You feel the creation of it. And so it's like this perfect little bead of a thing that doesn't feel like it's saying anything larger than it is about itself and these very specific people.
I don't get any sense when I either read the book or watch the movie that you are supposed to consider this to be, this is how these people are behaving because this is the way people behave.
Right.
I think that
it's because of the way these particular people behave.
Right. And particularly with one character, there is absolutely no...
Right.
You know...
There's no sense that some of these people are typical.
These are not stand-ins for you.
Right.
one would hope. Yeah, and I got to say, I mean, and maybe this is in part a product of the fact that I haven't read the book and I'm the person here who hasn't. I loved this movie.
Oh, cool.
I was completely smitten with it through and through. I was fascinated by it. I was haunted by it. You mentioned, Glenn, that there's a little bit of an airlessness to the movie, that these are such craftspeople doing crafts the entire time, that there's a little element of like you are watching a perfectly composed puzzle being put together. But I loved that. It's a mystery, and the fact that it is made by an amazing craftsperson in Gillian Flynn, an amazing craftsperson in David Fincher, amazing craftspeople in Rosamund Pike, and Ben Affleck, I'm sorry, we just have to at some point admit that Ben Affleck is incredibly freaking talented and a really, really good actor who's made a bunch of really good movies.
I think he has, I don't know that he has a ton of range, but I think when he is in the right role, which when I wrote about this for the blog,
neither does Pacino.
Right, no, of course. Neither, frankly, the writer who I remember coming up with this, when my friend Sarah Bunting first wrote about this idea of dimensions for actors, where some people have tremendous range and some people just have great depth at one kind of character.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
She was talking about James Gandolfini.
Right.
It was not meant to be a negative thing at all. He's not an everyman.
Right.
But when you put him in the right part, he's amazing. And to me, what I really like about Ben Affleck in this movie is the same thing I like about Hugh Grant in the best movies that he has done, which is that edge of its likability, and yet there is something untrustworthy about it.
Right, a callowness.
There is a callowness, and
reckless,
I think when he is able to kind of lean into that quality so that you really don't know what to make of this guy, and you turn out to be absolutely right not to know what to make of him, and certainly not to take his literal man on the street opening in this movie at face value.
Yeah. Right. He gives very good slump. There is a lot. Yeah. He says a lot with his slump.
That's true. The film looks great. I think the cinematography is amazing because, again, there's a scene in a lake house where we never see the wonderful vista of the lake. It's all about we're always inside that house.
Right.
And there's
it's beautiful, and yet.
This is a little spoilery, but part of this film is a thriller, and there is a very bloody scene. The immediate aftermath of that very bloody scene, I remember thinking, that is gorgeous.
Yeah.
That is beautiful. And I was like, did this film just make me a goth? As I sat here,
actually coincides with a really important musical moment, too.
Right, it does.
So
you're
every
right.
single part of it is, that's gorgeous. Grand Guignol and all. I was into it.
Yeah, I don't think that the acting in this movie should go unremarked on beyond Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. I think there are a bunch of wonderful supporting turns in this movie.
Yeah.
I think Tyler Perry.
Tyler Perry playing a lawyer.
A lawyer who gets to deflate a lot of that claustrophobic quality quality of the film that, yeah, that the score creates, the situation creates, you suddenly have somebody puncturing that with humor.
And a very naturalistic kind of performance, which is very different from this kind of woozy sense that you're getting from the rest
he's
of the
movie. He's terrific.
I was relieved every time he was on screen, which I think I was meant to feel. And I loved it. He's tons of charisma.
I loved Kim Dickens.
Kim Dickens as Boney.
As Boney, the detective who is in part the conscience of the film and in part an audience surrogate trying to figure everything out.
So, your wife has no friends here. Is she kind of standoffish? Ivy League? Rubs people the wrong way?
She's from New York. She's complicated. She's got very high standards.
Type A? Well, that can make you crazy if you're not like that. You seem pretty laid back. Type B. Speaking of which, Amy's blood type.
God, I don't know. I have to look it up at the house.
You don't know if she has friends. You don't know what she does all day. And you don't know your wife's blood type.
Sure, y'all are married.
I maybe it's type O.
Where are her folks? New York?
Yeah.
Can they get here in time for this press conference tomorrow?
Tomorrow? I have no idea. I haven't talked to them.
You haven't called your wife's parents yet?
I mean, you can't get a signal in this building. I've been in here talking to you.
Well, call them, please, Nick, now.
She is fantastic in it. I like the fact that Patrick Fugit from Almost Famous is still kicking around.
As I think Chris Klimek, our friend, pointed out, has the same haircut.
Same hair. Almost Famous.
It looks exactly like Carrie Coon as Ben Affleck.
She was
amazing.
She is fantastic in this movie.
Maybe this is just touching a personal nerve, but the performance of Missy Pyle as the hateful Nancy Grace surrogate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The fact that this movie just really hates Nancy Grace.
This movie hates Nancy Grace. That is absolutely true. I think those are all great points. I think they're all extremely strong performances. Stephen, we've had the Gone Girl soundtrack on NPR Music as a first listen.
Yeah.
What is your take on that soundtrack? I know you talked about it last week as editing music.
Yeah, I've had a lot of feedback on my mentioning the Gone Girl soundtrack as editing music since I talked about it. And I've used it as editing music a couple of times. And it is, the problem with it as editing music is that it's unsettling. There are specific pieces.
You want to call the police.
Well, yeah. There's just a sense that something is amiss.
It's fine if you're editing a true crime novel.
Well, if you're editing something and you really want to bring out the horrors of what it is you're looking at, it doesn't fade into the background. It has a way of getting just under your skin, but it's very, very effective in the movie. Yeah. It unsettles you when you are meant to be unsettled, which is something that Trent Reznor is very good at.
There were places where I felt like I was getting a little too much of it. There were places where I felt like it was a little inescapable in the first half. Mm-hmm. Places where I felt like, okay, I get it. And it was kind of like doing like the ooh.
It's like, I get it, portent.
And you just, I want to bring up one more thing, which is reportedly Reese Witherspoon, who is a producer on this movie, bought the rights to this book thinking that she would play Amy. Mm-hmm. But then she got David Fincher on board and he said no. This at least is the story.
Yeah. Which, makes a certain amount of sense.
But she bought the rights to the book. It was really interesting. I read an interview with her where she kind of said, when you get somebody like David Fincher on board, if he says he doesn't think so, you know. And she's got a movie coming up called Wild that we saw in Toronto in which she is wonderful. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to me to contemplate, having seen this movie, could I imagine Reese Witherspoon being really good in it? And I thought, yes, I think I could.
Yeah.
Really?
I guess I was so blown away, but I just loved Rosamund Pike. But
it's nothing against Rosamund Pike. It's strictly the hypothetical.
She's a little too pert to do that cool Hitchcockian blonde thing. Yeah. It would have just been different.
Yeah. I think it would have required a transformation on her part that I think she has the ability to pull off.
I was going to say, you got to wait and see her in Wild. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to
it. Oh, I love her. I'm just now I'm partisan for Pike.
Yeah. Oh, no. She is absolutely wonderful. They're all terrific. Well, I assume that a lot of you have read the book or have seen the movie or are curious. I hope that you're satisfied with the level of non-spoiling. Again, as I said, we will also, in a couple days, we will have a little podcast where Barry and I will get into some of these deeper things. But come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you think, whether you saw it and whether you think we've lost our minds. I've heard that can happen. And our other topic today, sometimes we like to reflect, as it were, on our relationships with pop culture. And one of the many things that we've been asked over the years is, what have you learned? What have you learned from what you have taken in? And when I think learning, I think Glenn Weldon. So I am going to Glenn to kick off our conversation about what have you learned from popular culture.
I thought this was a great question, and I didn't have an answer. We stipulated that we wanted it to be actually learned, not like just, you know, sort of
life lesson.
Life lessons. Yeah.
But more like practical, what skill set do you have now because of some piece of pop culture that you don't have? That presupposes that I have a skill set, which I don't, to speak of. I mean, memorizing as a kid the Monty Python cheese shop sketch taught me the names of many an obscure cheese. Brie, Roquefort, Pont d'Évêque, Port-Salut, Savoyard, Saint-Brieuc, Carignan, Brisbois, Brissot. I could go on. I shan't, but I could.
Anyone want to hear me sing all the elements?
I was just going to say that Tom Lehrer doing the elements was...
I
know all of them. I could do it. I won't, but I could.
Bugs Bunny and Gilligan's Island taught me a little bit about opera, as we touched on last week.
Sure.
And Looney Tunes taught me all kinds of references to 30s and 40s Hollywood. I think I was the only kid in third grade at Weston Thornbury Elementary who had a Jerry Colonna and a... and a Ray Milland impression in his back pocket.
And very often may not have known who they were.
Exactly.
But just know that that's a thing.
Just knew what they did.
And Stephen has talked many times about The Simpsons serving the same function.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Yep.
In terms of teaching cultural references through endless
For me, it was not only Looney Tunes, but old Jack Benny radio shows.
Sure, absolutely.
So I would know all the cigarette advertisements of the 30s.
Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, the 1982 film, Steve Martin film, taught me. There was this whole world of film noir that I might want to get interested in, which I did. But I did come eventually back to a sort of life lesson. The 1995 novel High Fidelity by Nick Hornby was about a man who goes through life with lists, top five lists, and they are meant not simply to provoke conversation, they're meant to win arguments. He goes through life with this, these are the top five X, Y, Z, and they're an impulse to rank and to codify. Now, he's a music nerd, I'm not a music nerd, but I was doing this for a lot of different things in my life at that time. And also, you know, I was going through life with a checklist of to get with me, to be my romantic partner, because I'm such a gift, you need to like the same bands, the same books, the same TV shows, the same films. And what that is, what reading that book really showed very clearly to me is that is emotional masturbation. That is narcissism. That is like, I get tired of hanging out with me already. The idea of dating me? Oh my God. No way in hell. Similarly.
Yeah, you did marry someone who is not you.
Not me. No, but that's kind of the point. I mean, I think what I wanted was to avoid the part where you are trying to of introducing somebody to something you love, which, because it can go knees up pretty quickly. And when it goes bad, it feels terrible.
Yeah.
When it goes right, it feels so wonderful. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to cut through all that and be on a common ground immediately, which is just narcissism.
How about you, Stephen? What did you? What did this get you thinking about?
Boy, this just sent me spinning in about nine different directions. First of all, I mean, we mentioned briefly Tom Lehrer.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the recitation of the elements, but like the identity of people like Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky, whose name I can still recite, even though I have since forgotten who he is.
And he's a Russian mathematician. He plagiarized, didn't he? He plagiarized.
Plagiarize. Let no one else's work evade your eyes. Remember why the good Lord made your eyes. So don't shade your eyes, but plagiarize. Only be sure always to call it, please, research.
So, you know, lots of these names have spun around in my head. I mean, we mentioned Looney Tunes, you know, that was certainly a big thing. Bloom County and Doonesbury, the comic strips, were kind of my introduction to a lot of politics, you know, even though it was obviously just from one fairly predictable perspective.
Yep.
I'm seeing play out at home the fact that my children, but particularly my son, they are obsessed with the Food Network. Glenn and Linda have both talked about your love of Cutthroat Kitchen. Huh. My kids, particularly my son, are suddenly like freakishly obsessed with it, and now when I'm attempting to cook, it's things like, oh, Dad, you really want to get a sear on that.
Yeah.
And so,
true.
And that is straight up pop culture teaching my kids an interest and a life
how
skill.
How to make a steak. Yeah.
You know?
Hell yeah.
So like little throwaway moments here and there. I mean, just The Simpsons had a gag about poison ivy where, you know, Marge says, remember kids, leaves of three, let it be, and Homer says, leaves of four, eat some more. And I remember that leaves of three, let it be. That's how I remember remember that is because Marge said it on The Simpsons. It's the only way I know not to, like, eat poison ivy.
That's so, the only way.
So, you know, Schoolhouse Rock, a million different How a Bill Becomes a Law, helped me copy edit The Onion because I was constantly correcting How a Bill Becomes a Law stuff that I learned through Schoolhouse Rock. I learned through Pee Wee's Big Adventure that there's no basement in the Alamo.
There you go. Smart.
Yeah. So they might be giants, band that I have enjoyed over the years is constantly, now part of it is they have an album about science, they have an album about the alphabet. I required less information about the alphabet via
the science was sure helpful.
The science certainly
James K. Polk, a lot about James K. Polk.
A lot about James K. Polk.
Made sure the tariffs fell and made the English sell the Oregon Territory. He built an independent treasury. Having done all this, he sought no second time.
So yeah, for me, it's really just a little tiny bit from everything.
Wow, that is an impressive list. I enjoyed your list very much. What about you, Barry? What did you learn?
I really sort of drilled down on this because I don't know if you know this about me, but I am very, very well versed on British history, European history in general, but I am terrible on American history. Like almost everything I learned about American history, I learned from Quantum Leap.
That is fantastic.
But and not just, oh my goodness, the JFK, that was a sad ending. Not just that kind of thing. But I mean, I'm really not kidding. I flunked so much American history in high school. But also just sort of things like, oh, Buddy Holly wrote Peggy Sue. If you remember, there's the moment that Sam actually sort of suggests the lyrics. So I learned a lot of just, you know, actual, you know, major American moments. That is the theme. You know, Apollo 13. I mean, thank God for Ron Howard, really. That was my introduction to space. And
you learned that Apollo 13 was piloted by Scott Bakula.
Exactly right. Forrest Gump. Exactly. So helpful. But now, you know, so that has been really, that's a big deal. And, you know, what's so great about it, and I'll echo what Stephen has said, is that now that I have kids, I get to say, hey, we should read this book. And really what I'm doing is learning about Apollo 11. I knew about 13. Was not clear on 11 until I had a kid.
Yeah.
So, which was the really important one, if you'll remember. I really thought the Eagle Has Landed was like a reference that you used when like the president's helicopter landed. I didn't realize it was a reference to the moon landing until literally I had a 2-year-old. So, who is also way more versed on the whole lunar module situation than I am. But
they tend to be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's also slightly more interesting. So I'll also say, and this is in the life lesson category, sorry. You know, I watched Murphy Brown with my mom all the time. I would say that she was a real formative influence on me.
Me too.
And one thing, maybe a silly thing, but it was the first time I was like, oh, I could just have a baby. But I could do that. And that was actually, at the moment, I think I was in high school, that was sort of freeing.
Yeah.
Not that I wanted to have one immediately.
But certainly something that, in theory, people do.
Yeah, exactly. But it was the first time I had really seen that borne out, because up until then, I had been reading a lot of, you know, historical romance, and it was real. Generally didn't go well, the out of wedlock things.
Right.
That was a woman that I could sort of look at and feel a certain way about. And there were a lot of those sort of workplace relationships I felt were sort of important to me. And then, you know, I have to say, I really, as a book person, I was introduced to so many stories via pop culture that I then went on to sort of read the literary version of. So this is embarrassing, but I was not really a Jane Austen person. You know, I had read Pride and Prejudice, and that was kind of it. And then I think when Clueless came out, I was like, what a great yarn. And that was when, and this is a true story. And I am like, you know, a literary lady. I like the lits. But it was really not until Clueless came out that I really delved into Jane Austen. Mm-hmm. And it sort of propelled me into, you know, and especially propelled me as a more grown-up person than the first time I had read Pride and Prejudice. So that was a good thing. So there have been so many moments where I've seen something on screen or on small screen that has, you know, really been an opening for me to explore the kind of the more bookish elements of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that has been really important to me.
Barry, for your sake, I just wish that David McCullough had written one of his massive tomes called JFK, : That Was a Sad Ending. That would have been great. For you, I wish that.
Although it does remind me to say that if it were not for John Adams, the HBO series, I mean, there's a real big piece of American history that I would have missed.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
You know,
there's historical dramas, they will catch you up.
Oh, my God.
For me, I sort of went in one of the same directions as Stephen, which is that I have actually watched a fair amount of instructional television in my life. And I think with something like cooking shows, I mean, I think a lot of people look at that and say, well, what are the odds that you're going to make that exact thing? And it's not that. And this is my feeling about like something like Top Chef as well. It's that if you watch enough of it, it begins to seep into your mind kind of what goes together so that when you do start to find yourself in the house and you have a bunch of stuff, you do start to have a little bit of a knack for what might work that if you sit and think about it, you realize, I got this from the Food Network. Like, I got this from the Food Network, and I got it from a ton of episodes of Top Chef. And from seeing on Top Chef, people judge this didn't work for this reason. The whole concept in cooking of balance, of that you're supposed to take something sweet and balance it with something, you know, savory, less sweet. That you have to kind of cut extreme sweetness with something spicy or acidic or something like that so that it isn't so overpoweringly sweet. Those are absolutely things I learned from instructional television. And I would say the same thing about decorating shows, like on HGTV. It is not so much that I have done specific decorating projects that I saw on there, but when I was moving into the apartment I'm in now, which, as everyone knows, because I talked about it endlessly, I painted myself, I do think that having seen people do that kind of thing and having seen people pick colors and having seen people execute that kind of project made it less intimidating. And so instructional television is one. The other one is, one of the ways that I find pop culture kind of enlightening for me is when I observe my own reactions over time. It almost becomes like something where you can put your hands on it at one time and it feels a certain way, and you put your hands on exactly the same thing 5 years later and it feels really different to you, and you realize that you are the only thing that is different. And part of that is just obviously age and maturation. But you figure out something about the way I think about things has changed. And that's very true of a lot of things I thought were romantic when I was younger. This, to me, is the story of Reality Bites, right? Is that when I first saw it, it had this sense of like, yes, I get this whole shaggy dude. I get it. And there are moments in the first half of that movie, for all of what its reputation is, there are moments in the first half of that movie that are stunningly correct. And when I first saw it, I think I was really overwhelmed by it. And also, I was young and I sort of thought, like, yes, this is how this should go. And then, you know, 5 years later, you watch it and you say, but that never happens. And this is the point. Everything in this movie is true up until I have a planet of regret. Y'all know what I'm talking about, ladies. And so sometimes for me, it is reacting to something over time. And that's when I get the life lesson part. But I definitely think that all of you should come and find us and tell us what you have learned from pop culture, because, you know, you're likely to have answers at least as good as ours. So find us on Facebook or on the blog. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, stop me if we've talked about this already on this show, but I'll say I actually don't generally like to watch the Travel Channel because travel shows just don't appeal to me that much. But I have found one that apparently has been on the air forever. It's called Bizarre Foods. Have you guys seen it?
I think I've seen bits.
I love this guy so much that I did the thing where I've now filled my husband was like, why is our DVR completely inert? It can't be moved. Like, it's because it's filled with Andrew Zimmern, the adorable little bald host of, he's so adorable, of the show. And the thing about it is it is like, it sounds like it is about bizarre foods. You know, there's definitely a lot of balls getting cooked in butter. But it's also, turns out that I love a travel show if I'm being taken through in this culinary way, which he does. So the most recent one that I saw, he was in Alaska and ate all of these things, some of which were delicious and some of which were not, clearly. But what was so terrific is that he has two gifts. One is that he is really, really, he is a certain kind of foodie that you would think could be kind of snobby with all the people that he's coming across in these small towns and sort of odd places in America and outside of America too. He's so warm that you can tell that everybody just loves him, and his enthusiasm is just absolutely, you know, overwhelming. And then he is just so absolutely fabulous at describing the food that he's eating. So, you know, one of my complaints about Top Chef is often I want better descriptions of the dishes. I want to know exactly what the mouthfeel is. I want, you know, I want the closest experience to eating it. And this show, he does that better than anyone else, I think, on TV. Now, he's doing it for things like stink eggs, which are basically spoiled salmon eggs, you know. And he's doing it for gumboots and other kind of disgusting things and the occasional, yes, penis. It's kind of marvelous to hear somebody sort of take a bite of something that you would and say, okay, well, that's, I'm tasting ammonia and rotted flesh and spoiled onions. This is a real description, by the way, of a thing that he said on the last show. All these flavors come to mind. Who describes it so that you, I feel like I have all of the experience of tasting the spoiled salmon eggs without ever actually having to do it. And yet he's also doing it in this way that he is having this wonderful time with the people that have been eating stink eggs for centuries and really, really love it. I highly recommend it. It is just, it's just filled with good nature and delicious things and some really, truly terrible things. And I think you'll love it.
Well, thank you very much, Barry Hardiman.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
I saw a tweet go by on Monday of this week for the 6.32 million people who follow The Onion on Twitter. And as you know, I used to, I worked there for 12 years.
I've heard that.
Before I came to NPR. And they decided just in the midst of a whole bunch of jokes. I mean, if you follow The Onion on Twitter, they are just peppering you all day long. I mean, every few minutes, it seems like there's a new headline comes through. And what blows by on a Monday morning, but a story from like 1996 with the headline Area Teens Wed, Horrible Life Awaits Pair. And like many Onion stories of that vintage, I can spot the writer and can look at it now with a fresh set of eyes and wish I could cut every seventh word from the text. But the photo that accompanies that headline, which ran in black and white because that's what The Onion did in those days, was from my 1995 wedding.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
And very, very, very few people noticed. I heard from three people. Two of them were people I went to high school with, and one was Margaret H. Willison, who somehow recognized my childlike visage.
With your different hair.
Yeah, we were 22.
God, I'm itching to get to the internet.
You can see.
Oh, you're going
to
love it.
You'll see how wedding dress fashions have evolved since 1995.
It's true.
But it filled me with a certain amount of, I don't even know, shame about how I've aged.
I was going to say warm nostalgia for your time at The Onion.
Warm nostalgia for my ex-wife's patience with having her photos run in
that,
The Onion.
That is incredibly kind
and generous.
Classy and generous.
So seek it out if you want to know what I looked like as a 22-year-old whelp.
That's fantastic.
The other thing is, you know, we mentioned the score for Gone Girl, and I talked about in last week's episode that I have an iTunes playlist called Ambient for Editing, and it's just instrumental music that I listen to while I'm editing. And I have received a flood of inquiries as to what else is on your Ambient for Editing playlist, and it occurs to me that I should probably just make a blog post out of this, but I wanted to throw out, just pepper people with recommendations for musicians whose music they should listen to while editing. Barry, I know you will feel me on Arvo Pärt.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Who specializes in these very smeary, symphonic, beautiful, very just eardrum.
I'll feel you on anything smeary.
I'm not sure entirely what that means, but I'm going to go with it. Anyway, Arvo Pärt, composer, really, really beautiful stuff. We have in our first listen series right now an album called Tomorrow Was the Golden Age by a group called Bing and Ruth, which is perfect for editing. Brian McBride from Stars of the Lid, a band I mentioned last week, The Calm Blue Sea, which is this very stormy, beautiful, rousing instrumental music. I think I mentioned Flying Lotus, maybe I didn't. A group from Indiana, I believe, called Metavari has a song called Pacific Lights that I've listened to over and over and over and over again while editing. A guitarist named Nathan Salzberg, a pianist named Nils Fromm, Rice Boy Sleeps, which is Yonsi from Sigur Rós. Also Sigur Rós, because he sings in a made-up language, is great for editing. The Latvian Radio Choir. I swear to you, our classical people swear by this album from, I believe, just last year, maybe it was the year before, Rachmaninoff Vespers. It's beautiful. Also great while driving. The Twin Peaks soundtrack. Yep, Twin Peaks is coming back. I used to, when I was in college, listen to Angelo Badalamenti's score all the time. And finally, two slowed down songs. Some genius took Justin Bieber's song You Smile and slowed it down by 800 times. So it is 35 minutes and 28 seconds long. It turns him into a celestial choir boy. Really amazingly beautiful. Someone did the same thing with the Jurassic Park theme, which becomes this very slow-moving movie score. Very beautiful. I listen to all of those when I'm editing, and you should too.
All right. Cool. Thank you, Stephen Thompson.
You don't have to be editing. You can just... I had people asking, I need music to code by.
Thanks.
All of this stuff
Thank
works great.
Thank you, Stephen. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
As Stephen mentioned, Twin Peaks is coming back, and we did a small batch on just that very subject.
That's right. I had lots
to say.
Yes.
It made me so happy we needed to break it out and do a separate thing. But what's left is that this week it was announced that beginning in February, Image Comics will be publishing two ongoing series based on characters from The Thrilling Adventure Hour,
which, as
I may have mentioned on this show once or twice, is the greatest thing. So Beyond Belief will be written by Ben Acker and Ben Blacker with art by Phil Hester, who I first discovered doing a really great run on Green Arrow, color by John Rausch, lettering by Marshall Dillon. That's a great team. Sparks Nevada, Marshall on Mars will be written by Acker and Blacker with art by Jay Bone, who has this amazing, very cute, cartoony style that is just incredibly charming. Jordi Belair on color and Marshall Dillon on lettering. That is another fantastic team, regardless of the topic, regardless of the subject, regardless of the characters, great teams on these books. A huge part of the fun of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, of course, are the performances from all the Work Juice players. You'll miss that in this, of course, but, you know, so this won't replace The Thrilling Adventure Hour in my heart, but I will build an annex and let them live there.
Nice. That's wonderful. Thank you, Glenn. What is making me happy this week is a Tumblr. This Tumblr is called It's Like They Know Us, and it consists of basically stock photos of parents and children presenting them in various stages of extraordinary joy and happiness, doing things that no one enjoys. There is, for example, a photo of a very happy, thrilled family around a grocery cart at the store, all just happily posing and kind of goofing for the camera because they're so excited about this trip to the store. And under it, it says, I love going to the store with multiple children. My toddler always goes right into the cart and never desperately clings to anything within reach like a cat being put into a bathtub only to then chuck all my groceries across the store like a demented Donkey Kong while my two oldest get into a fist fight because one of them got to put an extra thing on the checkout conveyor belt. Whee! Then there is one of a woman sitting at her computer with her baby on her lap, and she is peacefully working on her laptop with a child on her lap. And it says, I'm just going to post a quick question about my baby's eating, sleeping, pooping habits. I am sure it won't escalate from friendly advice into a fiery mega battle of parenting philosophies fueled by deeply held beliefs, anecdotal evidence, and links to articles no one ever clicks on. And it is all like that. And it is extremely funny. I specifically recommend their breast pump imagery, which is taken, I think, from a lot of breast pump advertising, which is meant to lead you to believe this is all very glamorous. And so I enjoyed that very much. Again, the Tumblr is It's Like They Know Us, which is at, I believe, itslikethenowus.tumblr.com. Mm-hmm. And we will link to that. And so that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And you can follow Barry at B Hardiman. That's BHARDYMON. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, REEDY. And our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. And as always, you can follow our producer, emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Fall is here, so get cozy and take a cruise around iTunes for lots of other NPR podcasts, including How to Do Everything, Thoughts on Regrettable Television, What Happens When Your Brilliant Plan Falls Apart, and What Your Homeowner's Insurance Policy Really Says. Browse them all on iTunes under Podcasts.